The CEO Roundtable brings together operations professionals at the top of their game to define and explore what it means to be highly effective in a scale-up organization. And what sits at the heart of it is highly curated peer-to-peer roundtables where COOs talk about things that matter.
I absolutely love my roundtable. We've been together for about 2 years, and without exaggeration, I have made friends for life.
To find out more, go to coroundtable.com. That's coroundtable.com. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Operations Room, a podcast for COOs. I am Brandon Mensinger, joined by my lovely co-host, Bethany Ayers. How are things going, Bethany?
Yeah, they're going fine, Brandon, thanks. I have this new super big monitor, and I can see myself really clearly, and the light is shining in a way of every single wrinkle under my eye, and I know I have to stop smiling.
Right. What do you mean? It causes more wrinkles? Is that what you're saying?
It totally causes more wrinkles. I guess they're smile lines, right? I should embrace them. Embrace them in the age.
Is a smile line an actual thing, or is that made up? Because like, just because you smile more doesn't mean you're going to get more wrinkles. It seems ludicrous to me.
Well, because I guess you either get wrinkles from smiling or you get like jowls from frowning. So you just have to pick your poison. I'll go for the smile lines.
Nice. What do I have then? I don't know if I mean, I don't smile a tremendous amount, but I don't jowl, growl. What's the reverse of that?
Yeah, I guess like when you're just all down and everything kind of follows. Yeah.
I think I've got neutral face problem is what I have.
Yeah, but you also have like a portrait of Dorian Gray in your attic. You just don't age at all. You look exactly the same as like we first met. Yeah.
There you go. So I'm the everlasting 50-year-old that looks like he's 25. I love that. So here's the thing, Bethany. Yesterday afternoon, we had the birthday party for my son. He's now turned 4 years old. So we had the bouncy castle as a requirement, which all four-year-olds need to have. We upped the ante compared to the other parents by having Spider-Man come to the event. And he was phenomenal because Spider-Man, you know, he actually got on the bouncy castle with the kids. They played all sorts of games on the bouncy castle and so on. And then when we had to do the lunchtime, snack time, whatever you want to call it, he managed to get all the kids lined up and actually marched them out, and they all sat down in their chairs. So he was just a fabulous quasi-host in this case, and all the parents were very impressed. I think the part that kind of cracked me up slightly was he did pass the parcel. Every wrapping element of the pass the parcel has some kind of candy or toy associated to it. So every kid gets something, basically. So we did pass the parcel, but it made me think, because my daughter's birthday is next weekend, and she's 7 years old in this case, then she wants to play pass the parcel too. So we're like, oh, okay, phenomenal, let's do that. But in this case, we have to create the parcels. So what I was telling my wife was that we should create two pass the parcel games, one with layered candy as the requirement goes, but also create another pass the parcel game where there's just one present at the core of it, 1980s style, for the big winner and the big payoff in this case. And my wife was not keen on that. She was like, Brandon, no, we're not going to do that.
Particularly do that one first. So everybody is totally shocked when they don't get a present. You're like, that's life. And then you do the other one of like, and this is the fun life.
Exactly. This is the Bluey episode, because every kid was crying because they got nothing. And then it was a big blow up where the party didn't go particularly well.
I miss Bluey because mine are a bit older. So this is, heard of it, but I've never actually, I don't know.
It's the greatest TV show on earth.
I have heard this from parents, but like passed us by. We had Peppa Pig and Ben and Holly's Little Kingdom.
Well, that sounds pretty second rate to me. I don't know. All right. So this is the second moderated session from the Operations Nation conference that we did several weeks back. So last week's episode was Philip Lykin talking about no-code ops. No code, no problem, I think was the title of that talk. This talk for this week is the wartime COO, which was moderated by myself. And the guest in my case was Hugh Slater. Hugh Slater is the co-founder and COO of Olivia Health and the former COO of TravelPerk. And we had Bella Davis-Reamer, the head of operations from JobLift, join us as well for that conversation. And I guess what I wanted to do, Bethany, before we flip over to that moderated session, was to throw some stuff back and forth between ourselves in terms of this so-called wartime COO and see what we think. And the definition of the wartime CEO was the organization having an imminent existential threat to the business in some form. And obviously, a lot of companies right now, that threat is really a finance threat in a lot of respects in terms of their future funding in this case. So I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you was, do you think there is a practical difference today in terms of how you operate an organization based on being in a wartime scenario?
I think that oftentimes being a wartime COO is about doing the things you're supposed to do all the time, but you have to, rather than have the luxury of doing it when you feel like it. So being super focused and not trying to do everything, looking at the business case for every investment, watching your pennies, just absolutely achieving the very next most important thing before moving on to the next one. But you just don't when you have a load of money in the bank and things are going well and you're making hay, and then you suddenly become very expansive and often probably don't progress as well as you could have had you stayed more focused. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I agreed with Hugh Slater's comment, which the listeners will listen to shortly. His point of view is that in scale-ups, you're always in a existential threat mode, because the fact of the matter is you get cash and the cash is meant to burn, and you can burn it for roughly 18, 24 months, depending on how much revenue you bring in. So that timeline is very finite and the cash is very finite. So there is a real sense of urgency and that the stakes are high from the outset, given the fact that you have a timeline that you need to be hitting. There is no wartime CEO per se. What there is you have funding, you have a timeline, and that timeline is your lifeline, I guess, to get to the next round.
I can see that. I guess it's the difference between creating urgency and actually facing a true existential dilemma, which does focus the mind in a way that you've just raised a bunch of money, you need to spend it to reach the next goal. There's urgency, but there's also like a level of construct to it.
No, that's a good point, because I remember back at one of my previous companies, sitting in a room with the VP of finance and the CEO and looking at the forecast together. And I think we had a realization between the three of us that we were in quite significant jeopardy in terms of our financial forecast and the revenues that had flatlined at that point. So the second question was, how do you surface existential threats to the organization and inject a sense of focus without scaring people?
I think this is a really hard one and comes down to maybe the size of the organization, the level of experience in the organization as well, and oversharing. At peak, what we used to do as people were onboarded was have at least one, if not two, sessions on SaaS economics and SaaS metrics. And what does it mean? And also talk about what being a VC-backed business means and why we're looking at it, so that everybody had a level of understanding that meant that when you shared results on a monthly basis, everybody could understand what was going on. And we also spent a lot of time upskilling and supporting our managers so that they could really answer all of those questions, regardless of what part of the business they were in. I think it's all about providing as much context as possible before you then go in for the current state of affairs.
Yep, I think you're exactly right here, which is the transparency around the state of the business is important, but it has to be framed up correctly. Here's the reality of the business. Here's the context around that reality to ensure that people don't freak out. We need to think back to like why we joined this company in the first place. You could have joined any number of scale-up companies. You joined us, and the question is why? And really getting the leaders of the business to really articulate, here is our purpose. Here is our mission. This is why we're getting up in the morning. This is the whole point of the exercise here. And going back to basics is, I think, both a galvanizing message, but also a message of optimism.
Yeah, completely agree. I was always surprised the number of people who would ask in interviews whether or not we were profitable, or like, how can we be a business that isn't profitable? And like just having to explain venture and startups to them. Like generally it would be somebody who was technical, who just hadn't really ever thought about it before. The level of understanding is pretty low for a lot of people coming into the business. And it's just about making sure they understand.
So Ben Horowitz, he wrote this book. What was the book called again? I was going to say Making Hard Things Harder.
About Hard Things.
The Hard Thing About Hard Things. Damn, that's such awesome. Hard one to say. So at the end of the book, he talks about this concept of the wartime, not COO, but CEO in this case. Huge list. There's about 25 things that he lists there. One that he listed was that a wartime COO swears and doesn't speak in a normal tone. And I remember reading that. I'm like, what? What does that mean? Doesn't speak in a normal tone. What do you make of this?
Just the freak out. Yeah, I think it's like a point of observation rather than maybe directionally what you're supposed to do. But it's a way to figure out whether or not it is a wartime moment. It's like a diagnostic toolkit. Like, ah, swearing all the time. Check. We must be in an existential crisis.
It reminded me of a former VP of sales that I used to work with. And he was an expert at landing the F-bomb in a very effective way. He used it very judiciously and used it to great effect when he was talking about something. And I always had a certain level of admiration for him to be able to pull it off in a way where he didn't offend the audience, but he got his point across in a very pointed way, I guess. And I think there's something there. All right. So let's move on to our conversation with myself and Hugh Slater and Bella Davis Reamer talking about the wartime COO.
Lovely. So I guess what I wanted to start with was Ben Horowitz, the co-founder of Andreessen Horowitz, he coined this phrase, the wartime CEO. And maybe just a show of hands here, in the past 12 months for your organization, have you had budget cuts? Have you had hiring freezes? Or have you had layoffs in your company? If you can just raise your hand. Okay, wow. So a good 3/4 of the audience has had economic uncertainty applied to their company in some sense. So I think we're all feeling this pain tremendously right now. And this kind of wartime scenario is very ever-present, I think, for companies. And he defined wartime as an imminent existential threat to the business. Can you maybe give us a definition from your perspective, Hugh, in terms of what is a wartime CEO? When you think about implications for your organization right now, what are those implications in terms of how you operate the company?
I think the definition was quite good. Existential threat, but we're in startups, so unless you're profitable, which probably isn't many of us, we're always in existential crisis. So I think it's just a spectrum for me. There are good times when capital is abundant. And for me, that means decision-making. You can take more risk. You're allowed to get a bit chubby around the waist. You probably have a few table tennis tables in the office. And then there's real wartime. The fat goes out the window. You lean down and the risk is minimized because it's about survival, right? It's not about taking those big swings anymore. I think it was at Keith Raboy just today reminded us that we're still in survival mode, right? There should be no startup out there that thinks next year will be okay. It will not be okay. So when it comes to decision-making, and literally I was writing an Ocean page before I came on stage, the leadership team, it's about that. It's cut the fat right now. We had a go at that just a month ago. We're going again at the fat. Then it's going to be into muscle, right? We're going to have to cut some muscle for sure. And hopefully we never get to the point where we have to cut some bone. Because if you cut bone, coming out the other side is really hard.
Yeah, that makes tremendous sense. And then getting back to your metaphor, what's your definition for those categories? When you think about skeleton, muscle, and sorry, what was the other one?
Fat, tissue damage.
Sorry. Yeah.
Right. I think we all know fats. It's the WeWork office you might have in a remote place that nobody ever uses, right? That just goes straight. In fact, quite a lot of offices should just go out the window, in my humble opinion, if you're hybrid, or just get rid of it. Like, just save the 10 grand a month or whatever you're spending. For the short term, I would not advocate that for the long term. But I think we know the fact, right? It's the nice-to-haves all around the office. It's all the projects that are just nice to have that you don't know are going to deliver anything. They just stop, right? Muscle is, this thing is working, right? But actually it's for the short term, back to Bella's point, it's capital intensive and I don't see the ROI coming in the next 6 months. Sorry, you need to get into that at some point. And bone is just, you know, if you need to chop off your leg to survive, that's what you're going to do, but you're going to regret it, basically.
Okay, perfect. And then Bella, from your side of things, can you give us maybe an example in one of those categories in the past 6 months where there was a very specific discussion and debate within your company around what do we do?
One experience that I've had in recent years was to decide how we will be able to save money because of the pressure of the board. Of course, one of the first things that you think of is cutting people. I'm a servant leader. I really care about my people. I really believe in building people up, mentoring as well, trying to see how people can get to the next level. So for me, that was something that was very difficult to do, especially because I wasn't necessarily the person that took the decision. It was the CEO. But you are the one that have to go and give the bad news to the person. Especially in my case, where I had to do it, I had to cut about 50% of my team. And literally on Tuesday, I was talking with one of the girls and saying, hey, tell me, now that, you know, you pass probation, everything is going well, how can I help you? Do you want to stay with me? Do you want to go to customer success? Do you want marketing? What interests you? And literally on Wednesday, the day after I had that conversation, my C-level tells me, hey, you're going to have to cut her. And on Thursday, I had to go and tell her that. It definitely wasn't easy, but hey, it's something that you have to do if the company is completely squeezed out, doesn't have any funding, and maybe the board doesn't necessarily believe anymore in the vision of the product. So you have to make the tough decisions.
Wow, that sounds very painful. So this is probably a good segue to the next question, which is, especially as a leadership team and as a CEO, you often have this circumstance where you have to surface an existential challenge to the business. For example, we've got 6 months of cash left in the company, and you need to communicate to the company around this, but you want to do so in a way that's galvanizing, inspiring, and not freaking people out and having them run to LinkedIn to look for jobs, basically. So is there any kind of best practice or ways to approach that that you find are more successful than other ways of doing it?
For me, it starts way before wartime or the existential crisis of wartime, in that we're quite a transparent organization anyway. So we're very clear up front, and it's part of the recruitment process. You are joining a startup, like an early stage startup. We are not profitable, and it's our job to get us to survive, right? That's the relay race ahead of us. We've got that sprint to get to survival, and that's the tone that you have to set. And we do kick off every Monday afternoon. We talk about it. I talk about burn multiple. You know, if we're not spending the money in the right place, we're not going to grow. We won't raise capital. We are not in the game of turning profitable, right? It's about achieving the growth, getting the right metrics, raising more capital to go again. We've been very clear about that. But if you shy away from it to begin with and you hire people under the pretense that you're Google but a smaller version, that's a very hard thing to come back from. And actually, you're just hiring the wrong people. You want people who can sort of thrive in that somewhat chaotic environment. So the short answer is do it from the get-go.
Right, that makes sense. So very early on, setting the tone for really what kind of organization they're joining, the risk level that's associated to it, and making sure that's really set as an expectation. So maybe same question to you, Bella. Is there a way of communicating this in a way that actually inspires?
Yes, I agree with you. I think it's very important from the beginning to have that type of culture of having transparency in your communication. Unfortunately, if the tone is already set, in my case, for example, I joined companies. I'm in Series Bs and higher. I've only worked for startups that were in later stage. So everything was already set. So all I could do was affect what I could, so within my ops department. And in my case, what I always did, I was always transparent with my team, always, even the bad news. However, you have to do it in a way that they don't get freaked out and they don't start getting the Sunday jitters. Oh my God, I don't want to go to work. I made sure that I was transparent, but without sharing too much of the big bad decision that I've heard, right, when I was discussing with the executive. So I would say definitely transparency and making sure that you have one-on-ones also with each of your team members to check on them also. Because each person within the organization has a relationship with somebody else. Somebody might be friend with the head of marketing. They go out, I mean, in Berlin, everybody go drinking after work, beer and so on, right? So people might have relationships. So it's very important to also for you as a leader, have a good relationship with your report, so then they can share the information that they hear, and then you can adapt.
A different question, a little broader in nature, but as an ops professional, when you think about the risks that you should be vigilant about in the context of the company, what are those things more broadly?
Maybe it's because I came from a finance background, right? But I'm always looking at cash, the quote to cash process in particular. You know, what are we selling up front and how is that flowing through? You get super geeky about like DPO, DSO, right? But the things that actually matter, because it's cash. If you're not looking at cash and you're only looking at LTVs and CACs and other important SaaS metrics, but you take your eye off the cash thing. So anything that puts that at risk, and today we are at risk because everyone is going to start withholding payments. They're going to say, oh, yeah, your invoice says 15 days, but I'll pay it next month. That's when the payment... When you're living on the edge, that's the difference between payroll and no payroll. So for me, it's anything that puts cash at risk, and that might be the same as you withholding payments, right? It might be the same as not signing up to the one-year deal that gets you the 20%. So for me, it's just observing cash, seeing what's going on, looking at every payment. It sounds really boring, but that's the thing. That's the leading indicator that will tell you if there's something bad coming down the line, because anyone can manipulate a sales funnel, you know, pipeline and marketing or make the numbers look good, but what matters is our customers paying you.
Yeah, I'm sure your VP of finance will appreciate that. So the focus on the cash inflows.
You're welcome, any finance people in the room. Yeah.
But that makes sense as an ops professional, which is partnering with the VP of finance or the head of finance to ensure that there's a real focus on the actual budget itself.
I think the mistake that I've seen some VP ops make actually is assuming finance is somehow separate. I think financial information is just another data set. It's just another operational data set that you need to include. And if you look at it that way, put a bit more focus on that data being accurate, being timely. You shouldn't accept, you know, month end happening 3 weeks after the month. Well, that means you're blind for 3 weeks. Would you accept that in any other operational data? No, particularly not one that means you can't make payroll. So that sort of mindset shift, it's just another operational data set, and then get your VP finance on it.
Yeah, no, that makes tremendous sense. And then Bella, for yourself, same question. You think about the broader risk set for an ops professional. What is that for you in this case?
I will say, looking at the financial environment in the business that I'm in, we have been impacted a lot by the war in Ukraine, for example, and also the economic downturn in the US. So observing that, you just don't want somebody that comes into work, does the day-to-day task, and not look at what's going on outside in order to adopt the right strategy on time. And on top of that, looking at what your competitors are doing. If, for example, your competitor in the Netherlands is able to do it within 2 days, but on your side is taking 2 weeks, then there is a problem. So really observing what your competitors are doing and adapt quickly as fast as possible.
So then maybe just getting back to Mr. Ben Horowitz, the co-founder of Andreessen Horowitz. He has a quote in his book where he talks about one tactical recommendation that he suggests is really creating an HR machine in terms of a very efficient system to both lay off individuals, but also hire new individuals when you have the rebound effect. And I guess my question to you, Hugh, is that a good recommendation?
I'd go one level up, which is just resilience, right? I think it doesn't matter what department you're in, you should look at resilience. And for me, that means creating optionality, right? In the good times and the bad times, how are you going to scale quickly? And how can you close down costs when things aren't going as planned or there's a wartime situation? So I think he's absolutely right with the HR machine. It's amazing how often, I mean, recruitment teams always get it in the neck, right? You're too slow to recruit the sales team or too slow to recruit the tech team. Finally, you build the capacity in the recruiting machine. And it's like, oh shit, actually, we're freezing hiring. It's like, okay, now you need to fire your TA team. You just can't win. So for me, that comes down to the operating model. What is your operating model as a business? How are you building resilience into that team? So maybe you should only hire 2 permanent TAs and the rest, yeah, you'll accept the cost of it being outsourced, but that's a good cost to pay for the flexibility of, you know, switching on and off. So absolutely right in the HR, but I would expand it to beyond HR. I think you should look at resilience and optionality just as a core part of your operating model.
I would say it's a good recommendation, for sure. However, I think it's also very important to remember that at the end of the day, you have to lead with empathy. So in the sense that sometimes you will need to make very difficult decisions. So one example that I've experienced in recent years where the whole HR team needed to be let go, being made redundant, and now there was only one HR person. And you still have to deal with all the contracts that are coming in, potential lawsuits from the ones that are being made redundant. How do you deal with that? And simply because the company decided to focus on the sales part or the commercial part, you still have to deal with all the layoffs, but you also have to deal with the onboarding. How do one person handle all of this? If you are in a survival mode and you're in a crisis and you are forced to only have one HR person, it will be to implement cross-trainings, for example, right? Try to see who can step in. If you have a working student, for example, in the company, they can step in and help you, but also implementing some type of automation. So then the automation can assist you with the whole HR process.
It's really good advice, by the way. I literally took my BizOps team away for the morning the other day and we did a little 2x2. I love a mental model. So we did a 2x2 on what is the part of the core value prop to our business and our product and what is not, and then what requires a specialist versus a generalist. And then the idea is then you plot, not the people on that, but you plot the jobs to be done on that. And the idea is that for us, things like labor law, commercial, like that is not core to our business and it's specialist. That we will never hire those people. Fine, if we go IPO, maybe we'll have to hire a couple of them. But for now, we will never hire them. Whereas if it's core to your value prop, and I'd actually argue in a lot of cases, HR is core to your value prop. If you don't hire the right people, don't manage your culture well, you're in big trouble. core to your value prop and a bit specialist, okay. For BizOps, what we want to do is only hire internal capacity where it's core to the business and it's generalist. Because when that's the resilience part, because then we can move, if you're in HR, for example, and you're a generalist, we can move you somewhere else. So that's just the model we use to kind of create that resilience. And I did it with a team. So they got to plot everything on the map and they understood the model rather than top down imposing it. So just a hopefully a useful tool for people to bring that to life.
Yeah, well, that's a good way to mental map it. So what is the biggest crisis in an organization you've ever experienced? And maybe just walk us through that story of what happened, what you did, what the outcome was, and what the lessons learned were afterwards in that case.
Cool. Definitely TravelPerk. So you joined TravelPerk, they had GMV, but no revenue. So zero revenue. We got to 20 million in ARR. And then March 16th, 2020 came around, all travel stopped, right? So we're a tech company, VC-backed, doing very well, you know, on the hypergrowth journey, burning at the time about 2.5 million a month, which was well spent, by the way. The burn multiple was fantastic, but burning nonetheless. So at the time I was CFO, COO, CHRO, and overnight revenue went to zero. In fact, people had pre-bought travel, so we were giving refunds out to people. We did that because I think it was the right decision, but obviously airlines weren't giving out refunds, right? They were giving vouchers. So we were watching cash go out the door, but getting vouchers from airlines. Anyway, it was a total shit show. And literally we had a board meeting that week and we went from completely on-premise business, it was based in Barcelona. Everyone came to the office every day, about 450, 500 of us. Everyone very happy to just complete unknown, right? How long is it going to last? How long can we survive? So that week, actually, just before the board meeting, we were seeing the travel data in China and then Italy, obviously grinding to a halt, so we knew it was coming. I got the leadership team into a war room on the Sunday night and basically ran through what I just said. So what's fat, what's muscle, what's bone, and then the lens of sort of long-term, short-term. And we built a plan, just the four of us in a room over some pizza. So that when we went to the board, it's like, this is what we're going to do. And we're going to do it in tranches. So back to the optionality, right? This is our first wave of cost cutting. And to Bella's point, everything was about OPEX, right? One of our values was about our people. We're not going to give up that value of, you know, believing in our people at the first sight of trouble. So we did absolutely everything we could on OPEX and then some. And only, you know, eventually we got to furloughing people and pay cuts and actually then just voluntary redundancy. We were lucky not to make anyone redundant. But it was a disaster, and it was sustained, as we all know, right? So it didn't just last a summer. It went on and on and on. So it was incredibly stressful. At the time, I was living in Barcelona, two young kids. Barcelona was going to a hard lockdown, which I did not want to do with two kids in an apartment in the center of Barcelona at 40 degrees. So overnight, March 18th, we left the house, put the keys through the letterbox, never went back, just moved back to the UK, which was much better. It was bad here, but we had a lot more freedom. So had the whole life situation going on as well as work. So that was the situation. What do we do about it? We prioritized. We built a very robust comms plan. Transparency was at the forefront. Transparency isn't all or nothing, right? You've got to be transparent about some things. No point telling people everything if they can't do anything about it. So we were very clear about what was happening, how we were prioritizing. First, we were going to survive, right? So we'd do whatever it took to survive. And then we'd try and thrive was the mantra that we went through. So when we took actions, when we took pay cuts, when we furloughed, people understood the journey that we were going on. We ended up doing okay through the process. We actually kept the sales team, kept everyone in sales going. What it turned out is COVID, people weren't traveling, but travel managers realized the small bit of traveling they were doing was very complicated and they needed a solution. So sales were bringing customers on board, but there was no revenue at the time. Nothing was flowing through the books. So we had this potential revenue building up, which in the end we managed to fundraise on. Don't ask me how. Zero interest rates helps, obviously, at the time. So we managed to convince General Catalyst to give us quite a lot of money, 80 million, I think, back then, which kept us going. We then acquired another travel company because their valuation was depressed. So we raised 100 million in debt to acquire another travel company, all while burning about 3.5 million a month. So we took some big swings about a year into COVID. And then we came out, so what was it? end of 2020, things were starting to look better. Then Omicron, was Omicron 2022? I get mixed up with my years. Anyway, Omicron came and we all started crying again, thinking, like, what have we done? Like, this is going to be a disaster. Thankfully, that was very short-lived. And then we went from zero revenue to 100 million in about 9 months. We had very different challenges. I had to go and hire 1,000 customer care people, which was not easy. We were lucky, right? There is definitely some luck in that, but we followed, A, our values, right? So we didn't go hard on people to begin with. We did everything we could to avoid laying people off. And we looked at sort of fat, muscle, and bone. And those things just got us through. That, and I'd have to say, reminding people of the mission, creating this sense of belonging, right, I think was really important, because when everyone's at home on their own at that time, or scared, you're scared of your job, you're scared of life, right, you're scared for your family, we've very intentionally built a community team, actually, and their job was to talk about stories, to talk about this narrative, where we're going, why we're all in it together, and it really helped sort of pull people together. So I do think, I know you keep asking about communication, but that sense of mission, team, really mattered to us. Anyway, I feel like I waffled there, but hopefully that was helpful.
No, that sounds like a serious crisis that you went through.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine burning £3.5 million per month. That is a ridiculous amount of money.
It was a lot of money.
Wow, okay.
It's fine when you're adding 5 of revenue, right? So.
Yeah. You actually spoke about this quite eloquently in terms of the values and principles of the company really coming to the forefront in a crisis situation. But when the rubber hits the road and there's problems, things start to fall away, I guess. So purely as an example, if there's severance packages that need to be built out for individuals leaving the organization, there's always a debate and a question of what kind of severance do we give these people? Because the fact of the matter is, we have a cash burn, we're going to be out of cash in X amount of months, and you know, we've talked about having a culture of X and a value of Y, but we have a balance sheet that we're looking at. So when you have those rubber hits the road conversations, what's the best way to think about this?
We will not compromise on values. We actually call them agreements in Oliver, because I think it's a bit confusing to have personal values and company values. We call them agreements. Like, literally, you are committing to these agreements, and that's how you're going to behave. Obviously, nobody wants to fire people. But in the end, the prioritization is company, team, self, right? The company has to survive. So if it was going to get to the point where we needed to fire people, that was definitely an option, right? And we were very transparent with the company about that. Like, if that's what it is, if that's what it takes for the company to survive, we will do it. But to answer the specific question, honestly, it was a spreadsheet. And it was different by team. So a sales rep, if you're an enterprise sales rep, we knew that if we fired you and then in 6 months needed to hire again, it was going to be 6 months of ramp and then, you know, 3 months of drawdown. And, you know, so you can just put a number to that. Whereas it's different in customer care. For good or for bad, right? It's just an easier, more sort of transient role. So we just built a model. It was like, so that, and then the values, obviously then there's law, right? So you shouldn't do anything that would break the law in whatever jurisdiction you're in. And then we just picked the line on that. So it was very mathematical, but that's how we, in my opinion, that's how we had to do it. Otherwise it becomes ego-driven. It's who's the loudest exec ends up getting the most amount of money for their team. That's no way to run a business, particularly in crisis, right? So we just agreed on the model. We actually had a wall cabinet that we took outside of the executive team because it was getting too noisy in the executive team, and they had a job to do. We had an executive day-to-day job, and then we had a wall cabinet team, which I chaired. So we came up with recommendations there and took it to the exec team. But it was, for good or for bad, very mathematical.
Bella, last word goes to you. Values and culture, do they matter?
Of course they do. But when you are trying to survive, I think, unfortunately, some of it goes out of the window. You do your best to still follow the values that you have implemented for the company. However, in Germany, it's different. In Germany, there is a few laws that you have to follow. For example, your garden leave should be the probation period, like when you tell the company that you will be leaving in X amount of months. So they have to pay you this. And the loophole, however, is that the law is so much on the employee side that you can actually literally sue them and, like, get more. But I think most people don't want to go through this to try to, you know, get more money out of it. So most people end up signing. One point also in Germany, we will have a spreadsheet, look, like, have all the employees, but they look at who have children and who don't. And the ones that have children are prioritized, even though maybe they might not be the best performers.
I would, word of advice, be very careful about where you hire, even if it's through an employer of record, right? You end up still carrying that liability. So yeah, remote looks great until you need to fire somebody in Germany or Amsterdam or France. Like, it becomes incredibly, so back to resilience, like, looks good up front, ruins resilience.
Perfect. Any questions?
What were the roles in the war room? Because if it wasn't part of the exec team, I just really want to know who was there.
It was two of the execs. So myself, the chief revenue officer, and then our head of community, who sort of brought the values, made sure we didn't go rogue against our values, and that was it. So it was a subset of the exec plus a culture carrier, if you like. So I was coming at it from a cost perspective. I was like, we just need to get burned down. And JC, the chief revenue officer, was coming at it like, this is what the market's telling us, this is what customers are telling us, and trying to balance those two things. And then Uri, who is amazing at running community, he could use that information to help our comms afterwards, by the way, which was really powerful. He didn't need secondhand information. He was there in the conversation. And then he'd also contribute with a cultural or the employee perspective. So that's why it was a bit quite balanced.
Hi, my name's Carl. So we've identified financial is really where it comes down to at the end of the day, but we want to keep the culture side of things, and transparency is key to the team. Where do you guys sit on a sliding scale of kind of transparency of financials, from not leaving the executive team all the way down to kind of a Reed Hastings kind of financial literacy training and full exposure to the full sheets?
So how we did at my company, we used to have all ends every month, and we had a section about the finances of the company, and we explain each of the definition, what it means, so then people are not completely lost, right? Burnout rate, etc. So that's what we did, and we explained what's going on, how much cash we might have left without, I mean, sometimes we weren't saying completely the truth, just so they have an approximation. And yeah, so every week we had like all hands, and people were able to answer, to ask their questions if they had any.
Also on the Reed Hastings side, to give a very concrete answer, we had our offsite 2 weeks ago. I ran a session on burn multiple to the whole team. Like, this is what burn multiple is. This is how you should use it in your decision making. This is why it's important. And again, that doesn't work at scale, by the way. But I think when you're small, the more context people have, the better decisions they're going to make.
Any closing parting shots?
No, thank you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was a fabulous conversation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Aw, huge thank you.